You okay, Greg? Everything all right with you?
I
know it's a challenging time.
What is challenging times?
Well, I mean, I'll see what's trending on Twitter in the last 48 hours.
The Devils are 1-8, 1-8 and 1 in their last 10.
Well, there is that, too. See, Taylor Hall didn't practice with the team this morning, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Carrie Fisher, or as you like to call her, Princess Leia.
Oh, yeah. I was also thinking you had to be a bit more specific. I mean, you know, I've also seen that a satanic Cheeto is now the president of my country. So we've got that.
A satanic Cheeto. Wow, that's a whopper. Okay, that's good.
So, I mean, you're going to really... 2016 hasn't... You know, it's funny. I'll get to Princess Leia in a second, but I was seeing a year in sports review from this guy, Matt Ufford, who I know, and he made the point that while everything else in 2016 was atrociously bad, it wasn't that bad in sports. Like, the Cubs won, Cleveland
Penguins.
Won.
Yeah, Penguins were a nice story.
Yeah.
John Scott got to the All-Star game.
I mean, John Scott got
kind of good stories.
Good
but
stories
even
in
like
sports.
I'm really because I just think this is going to continue. This idea that somehow 2016 is the culprit and in 2017 can't get here soon enough because everything will be sane again and celebrities won't die. This is the baby boomer era. This is the baby boomer era of people that did a lot of bad things to their body for a long time. Cocaine. I hate cocaine. Sure. I love the way it smells. Like that's that old Rodney Dangerfield line. Like we should not feign surprise that a lot of, you know, well-known celebrities and celebrities that we love of the baby boomer era are now starting to say goodbye. And I think you do a 2016, it's just a byproduct of that. And they are going to continue.
And
to
not
do
only
so.
That, not only that, but celebrities who managed through their own skill or through repackaging or through subsequent generations just discovering what came before them transcended their peak of popularity. You know, so Carrie Fisher dies, and she was just in a Star Wars movie last year. Well, and also this year, kind of. But like, you know, in a different time, we would remember her as Princess Leia for three movies. But those three movies ended in 83. You know.
Yeah.
But then they re-released in the 90s, and they reboot the series, the whole thing. So it resonates. All these deaths, Bowie resonates more. All these deaths resonate more because it isn't specifically like hearing about, you know, some guy from the 50s who, you know, my dad once saw and Ed Sullivan died or whatever. It's now all these artists from the 60s and 70s who then put out hits in the 80s and made movies in the 80s, who then were rediscovered in the 90s, whose music was then used in a thing in the 2000s. And these deaths just send ripples through different generations.
And a
you're
lot,
right.
Listen,
that's why they sting so bad.
And a lot of them, listen, man, and one of the lessons out of all of this, too, is, man, these are people that lived really hard. And if you could try to, and if you want to bring it to the sports realm as well, do we know, I mean, there's a few outliers, certainly, but elite level athletes, like high end athletes that burn bright through their, you know, their peaks, their 20s, these guys and girls don't live long either. Have you noticed that? Like, this isn't exclusive to, you know, the drug abusing rock stars and movie stars. I'm talking about athletes, relatively clean living people. When you burn your body that high for so many years, there's a price to be paid at the end.
Sure.
They're really like, how many athletes like, wow, man, he made it to 95. That story, it really doesn't happen in sports. I don't think that's any coincidence.
Oh, I hope there's a few of them that come out and wave to the crowd during the one centennial 100. What would the NHL? What would the NHL name it now? I'm gonna get the name right because I'm so overjoyed when the NHL decides to sell its naming rights to things. Here we go. Please refer to it going forward, Jeff Merrick, to the 100 greatest NHL players presented by Molson Canadian.
Yeah, that sticker's been on everything here for a long time.
So,
I can still remember when the switch was made too, because that brand Molson Canadian was for a long time they tried to make it as the party rock and roll brand, and so it was out of hockey, and it was anything rock concert was Molson Canadian, and I don't know when it was, but somehow it went back to sports. And the Bat Blue for the longest time, one of their chief rivals, was the main sponsor for Hockey Night for the longest time, and then they decided
Don Cherry's
to get out of the
dog
sports.
Named Blue.
Don Cherry's dog, but this is long before Labatt Blue.
Oh, okay.
Became like a sports thing, I believe. Correct, old-timers, please correct me if I'm wrong.
I love the idea of the beer company coming to Cherry in some meeting and being like, listen.
Okay, here's
we'll
the deal.
$100,000 a year if you name your dog Blue.
You know that dog you always have on television, the one that everyone loves? Okay, just listen. Just don't say no right away. But here, just listen to the pitch.
Well, you know, Budweiser was also the party rock and roll beer for a really long time. I mean, Spuds McKenzie, right? And then at some point they decided, much like a certain political party, that it's better to just sell America to Americans. Sell it to them. Shove it down their throats. The watery piss that is that beer because it's American beer.
Dude, Molson Canadian's been doing that for years. It's called Canadian! Okay? it's funny. We all look... Listen, just one final thing on this.
Yeah.
As Canadians, we all look down our nose at American patriotism. Oh, it's so blatant. Oh, it's so obvious. Oh, it's so crass. We are no different. We sell our flag soaked in maple syrup to ourselves all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't see it, right? And Molson Canadian is the perfect... Trust me, Canadians don't think of this as a nationalistic beer. They don't. But anyone else looks at it and says, would you buy a beer called, I don't know, Anheuser American?
No.
We buy one called Molson Canadian.
But it's funny because you're right. Because I think of Canadian Tire. There's a lot of self-identification going in, up in there
totally.
In your marketing. And
I
your,
know. But we like to we pretend that we're above it all. we've risen above this crass capitalism. No, we haven't. Not even close.
I hope I live long enough to see Target struggle. Because it was Target Canada was the thing that you had up there briefly before it crapped out.
Yeah, and Quebec was called Target.
Yeah, that'd be perfect. Because I would love if they renamed it Target America. And everybody's like, wait, what?
Target America. Sounds like Canadian Tea Party.
Yeah. I'm bummed that she died. Because I thought Carrie Fisher made it out of the wilderness when they said she was stable. But then... Someone pointed out to me the other night, well, sometimes you could be in completely horrible shape, but just staying in horrible shape, which is probably what happened. And I don't know. She was a special – it's kind of like the Holy Trinity, you know, her, Harrison Ford, and Mark Hamill. Mm-hmm. And now one of them's gone, and it's kind of like, wow.
I still remember seeing Star Wars as a kid in the theater. That's how old I am. And I'm pretty sure Carrie Fisher must have been my first boy crush. I got that when I was a kid.
Could be.
Honestly, I can't think of anybody else. That might have been the first. I mean, mind you, they had her prancing around next to nothing.
Yeah, well, the gold bikini.
In the movie.
Bikini story is hilarious because I think it was a situation where she was asking, why do I have to wear this outfit without a bra or something?
Saw that. Yeah, there's no underwear in space.
There's no underwear in space, George Lucas. Said.
Come on, guys. We've all heard bad lines. George Lucas spinning that one. Okay.
It knocks me on my ass as we kind of do this probably last show of the year. We lost Gordy this year, but Gordy might be lingering around 10 in the number of significant deaths this year. And I never thought that'd be the case when we lost Gordy Howe. I thought that'd be he'd be one of the last three names you see flash on the screen as the applause builds, you know?
For hockey was number one.
Clearly.
Right? For hockey he was number one. Lost Charlie Hodge. You know, that was the huge one. And he was still sort of active too, and a lot of those scouts in Western Canada still speak of Charlie reverentially, who gave a lot of guys their starts. But yeah, Gordie Howe was the one. And it was of course on the heels of Jean Béliveau a couple of years before that. But that's that era, right? Glenn Hall is going to outlive them all.
Bobby Hull is going to outlive them all.
Maybe.
That's the way the world is right now, sir.
You know what? He's the Keith Richards of hockey. Because look and you say, how is it still sharing oxygen with us?
That was just outside of my top 10 stories of the year was him... uninviting himself to the Winnipeg Jets Hall of Fame because of all the accusations that bubble back up of domestic violence and, he unfortunately, if he only waited a few more months, Nazi sympathy kind of came back around again in a way. So all you just had to wait that out.
Help get someone elected. Exactly. Specifically.
Bobby Hull, a man before, well ahead of his time, clearly. But then Patrick Waugh was number 10 on my list. That's how crazy it was. A coach who quit.
It was barely top 10.
It was barely top 10.
Yeah. It's, I'm just scrolling through your site right now. What did you have as most controversial?
So the most controversial person.
Dennis Weidman. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Had to be. It had to be because of what it begot. And by the way, number two on the list was Evander Kane, and number three was Colin Campbell. Number one had to be Weidman because the whole Weidman case was the first time they tested the appeals process, and it worked. And then the NHL goes to court, and then much like, you know, the concussion protocols and hits to the head rules, you can kind of track it back to Sid's injury. Like, you can track all this guys watching television for people who are possibly concussed stuff. You can track that back to Weidman. So it was a huge, just explosive moment. And then on top of all that, you have a linesman who may never be able to ply his trade again because of what happened to him. But Evander Kane second and Colin Campbell, not for the just for the John Scott stuff.
I may have put John Scott first. I know selfishly since we're sort of involved in it, but I might have put John Scott first because how many times has that ever happened, and B, will it ever happen again?
That was one
unique supernova.
I think if someone else had written the list, probably.
And hang on, Weidman is the same way, but it forced you to have an opinion. And what Scott did was reveal who was on the side of fans and who wasn't. Right?
Right.
How many times do we see, you know, establishment people come out and completely revolt against John Scott's presence?
Only to completely kiss his ass during the game through an NBC interview.
That happened too.
But it was also, you know, just the best controversies are the ones that aren't simply just the black and white debate, but also have all these sidebars and offshoots. And the other thing about the Scott situation was it was also a combination of remembrance and referendum on fighters too.
Yeah.
Because that was part of it as well. Like, you know, people saying, where have all these cult heroes gone? And other people saying, the last of a dying breed. And, like, popping champagne over it.
Hey, Columbus winning a lot of games, eh?
So is Minnesota. And in classic NHL fashion, fully expect Minnesota to lose the Islanders and the Blue Jackets in Winnipeg before we get the big showdown on New Year's Eve.
Because
fully
now both Winnipeg and the Islanders are playing decent. So they're going to shoot them both down.
Winning in Winnipeg's never easy, right? And you're right about the Islanders. They're starting to turn the corner a little bit right now.
Getting cold.
But, yeah, listen, to have two teams with giant winning streaks face each other on New Year's Eve would be an amazing moment for hockey were it not for these two teams being involved.
The triumph of the 2000 expansion.
Yeah, but
these
two
teams.
Could you imagine, just again, from a selfish American perspective, if it was like the Flyers and the Blackhawks with these winning streaks, and then they face off on New Year's Eve, and like the world stops for a couple hours to watch hockey. I mean, I'll be watching the Blue Jackets in the Wild, but I don't know how many, I don't know what kind of crossover it would have on New Year's Eve.
This is a wonderful story, and the NHL rightfully is, you know, trumpeting up the fact that the CBJs are doing great and winning all these games, and ditto for the Minnesota Wild, and it's awesome. Close your eyes, gentle listener. Greg, gentle co-host, close your eyes for a second, and imagine that's your Stanley Cup final. How are we feeling about that?
I'm feeling good from one particular perspective. Enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. In the sense that I think that both of those cities, both of those fan bases, both of those arenas would be the types of situations where it's a magnet effect for casual sports fans. Like, all of Ohio State is plugged into a Blue Jacket Stanley Cup final, right? Mm-hmm. Minnesota getting to a cup final activates the entire hockey community in Minnesota.
Yeah, so but outside of those, but outside of those borders, no, outside of those borders,
they're not sexy teams. They're not sexy teams. They're not sexy teams to American cities. They're not sexy teams to Canadian cities. They're not sexy teams.
I look at it like an outdoor game now. It's great for that local market. That's it. Everywhere else is kind of, unless you're a hardcore fan, it's sort of greeted with a shrug. And a lot of it is just the absolute non-presence of superstar players.
Yeah, that's part of it too, right? I mean,
the really good teams. So, like that Columbus power play is gigantic.
Right.
Devan Dubnyk is turning in a Vezina Trophy season. But is there anything you can hang your hat on? Like if you're us, right, at Rogers, if you're NBC and that's your Stanley Cup final, Torts versus Gabby?
It's Torts
Press
versus Gabby.
Conferences are great.
Which means it's Gabby. It's Gabby's. Like it's the big shot for Gabby, right? Against the yelling man. I don't know. Like
Torts would have some great ones. Oh, you know he'd have some must listen to pressers.
By the time the Blue Jackets actually make it all the way to the Cup final, the worm will have turned on Tortorella, and it'll become an amazing redemption story. The guy who couldn't, you know, barely lead his team out on the ice at the World Cup.
I don't know. He just kind of the buttons just popped off yesterday against Boston, despite the fact that they won, right? Burn the tape, 5-on-5, we're crap. We're never looking at that again.
So you're saying that you think there might be a little fuse lit. There might be a chance you might see the old Torts creeping in a little bit.
Don't you think? And then you compound that in the playoffs with this intense pressure where you're dying shift to shift. Yeah, Greg, it'll happen.
I will point out that I believe it was Bruce Boudreau on the other bench when John Tortorella assaulted a fan with a water bottle in Washington, D.C. Since we last spoke, I've further angered the Blue Jackets fans.
What happened there? All of a sudden on Twitter, people are saying, "Oh, I wish he was having a tough time with the CBJ fans." What'd you do?
I apparently, when they were in that playoff series against the Penguins, made a reference to their fans being called the fifth line. This completely left my brain, like many things do in life, that don't matter to me. And then someone brought up the fifth line to me the other night, and I found it to be one of the most absurd things I've ever heard, that they'd call themselves the fifth line, or that the fifth line was what was bestowed upon them, and started spouting off about how I was dumbfounded that any fan base would pick up on this as being their nickname.
So you mocked their fans and were then surprised when they fired back.
No, I wasn't surprised, because this was more of on top of a piling on about their team and how, you know, snippy their fans have been since they got good, because all of a sudden nobody in the Blue Jackets fandom ever had a doubt about the season or thought that their coach was a bad fit.
Except everybody.
And so it was more of a piling on. Plus I said I had never heard it before and people found an article in which I had cited it from a few years ago. So that's fine. I was wrong. But I still think it's stupid. Like the 12th man in Seattle for football makes sense. That means an extra guy comes off the sideline illegally and helps out on the play, right? The fifth line isn't a thing in a game. It's the players in practice that are scratched.
It's the black aces.
Yeah, it's the black aces. So why would you possibly want to be associated with
guys who are either too
injured or bad and they don't play?
Yeah, I get it from a marketing point of view and getting your fans involved and having your fans feel like as if they're somehow part of the outcome of these games. But here's a clue. When the game's on, players kind of tune them out.
I don't know. I've heard guys in the locker room after games crediting the fans.
Of course they say that. It's smart business to say that. Ask any hockey player on a power play when the crowd is screaming, shoot.
They don't?
By the time you get to the NHL, like by the time you get to the best league in the world, you've learned how to block that out.
I think a home ice advantage is a real thing. I think a fired up
crowd.
I do
too, because of line changes, line matchups. I do too.
I think it lights a little fire under you. if you're playing for the home team to hear the crowd going crazy.
I don't know about that one.
You go out there as a fourth line and skate a big shift and keep the pressure on for 2 minutes in the attacking zone and the crowd acknowledges your efforts. That's a pick me up right there, isn't it?
I just don't think that it resonates with players. I don't. I think they zone it out. I don't think they hear it.
All right, party pooper.
Sorry, fans. They cheer, like still go and cheer and have fun. But let's just not lie to ourselves.
Brian Burke heard the fans and he fired Ron Wilson.
That he did.
That's right.
Oh, coaches hear. Oh, listen. Oh, dude, trust me. Coaches hear it. Oh, yeah. Oh, no. Don't make any mistake about it. Coaches hear. Coaches hear all of it. Yeah. But players? Yeah, not so much.
Dmitry Filipovic is going to join us at 1:30, or I should say 30 minutes into the show, in case you're listening to this at like 11 at night. We're also going to answer a lot of questions on Twitter that came our way today when I said come ask questions, because the mailbag is overflowing. Mailbag, Merrick.
Is it true that you're taking, I'm just reading Karen Douglas's tweet here, is it true you're taking bids to change sneakers' name?
That was a joke about the Don Cherry bit we did before.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm just dropping in out of Twitter and trying to make a story. All right.
I have some questions for you, Jeff Merrick. One, will Sidney Crosby go 50-50?
No.
He's 5 goals off the pace right now.
No. Will not.
I think you need to be ahead of the pace at 30 games. And then there's a chance.
Because it gets tighter closer to playoff time.
Yeah.
You have to look at the schedule, too, and see who they're playing, who's out of it. Got to look at how many back-to-backs they have. Got to also have to look at, you know, who he's playing with. You know, one of the great stories of Sidney Crosby right now is how he's doing everything on his line. You know, last time I looked at it, he's shooting up around 25%, maybe 26%. His line mates when he's on the ice, 8. So here's the story. Crosby does everything. Everyone else on their line is fumbling the puck on their blade. And he's kind of at the same point production, too. Like this idea that the story right now about how Crosby's just, you know, oh, it's a new level for it's the same point level as it's always been. He just swapped out assists for goals.
23.
Because when he gives the puck to someone else on his line, they don't do anything with it.
23.8% shooting percentage on 105 shots. It's pretty damn good.
Yeah.
I still give the heart to Connor, though, don't you?
I do, yeah. I've been consistent with that from day one. He's lugging the whole team.
Shit, yeah. I was looking at Corey Schneider's numbers because I just wanted to make myself feel worse at the end of 2016. And he's got the second highest number of, and this is from Corsica, of sort of mid-danger chance shots faced.
Does second Corey highest?
Schneider, yeah. Second highest. Defense has been porous this year.
Yeah.
First, of course, would be...
Well, you don't send down Johan Avi, too.
Like, First, of course, would be Cam Talbot. Like, McDavid is dragging his team offensively. He's dragging his team defensively. He's just, like, got them all by the collar and just has them over his shoulder, and he's just, like, dragging their carcasses to the playoffs.
Look, do I have to do everything? Okay, fine. Just don't get in the way.
That's kind of right now. Right. Exactly. No, I still have to give it to him, for sure.
It's not even second full season.
It's insane. Oh, nice to see Mike Harrington come around, by the way. I don't know if he's always been on this or if he's just, you know, voicing a certain... Oh, because he wrote a column eviscerating Dan Bylsma and Tim Murray for their mismanagement. And in his laundry list of things that have kind of gone wrong for the Sabres... He said they ended up with Jack Eichel instead of Connor McDavid. Now, I was under the impression, as you know, Jeff Merrick, that...
Whoa. What?
What?
How is that their fault?
Well, you know, I guess it's just bad luck. No. I mean, right? Now, granted, I was under the impression that they were tanking for just to get one of the top two picks, not necessarily for McDavid. They're pretty happy with either guy, from what I remember. No discernible difference in quality between the two athletes, you see. They're happy with either guy. They just wanted a franchise guy, you see.
That was a beautiful goal by Jack Eichel yesterday against Detroit. That was gorgeous. It was beautiful. It's not Connor McDavid. It's not Connor McDavid.
No, he's not. And they wouldn't be where they are if they had Connor McDavid. See, also,
they'd be in a playoff spot right now if they had Connor
McDavid. Of course they would be. And they know it. It's just, you know, fans lie to themselves so damn much. You have to be honest with yourself. Like, look, here, let me help. From 1994, well, 95. From 1995 through maybe 2012, the Devils were really boring a lot of those years. Really boring. There.
Can be honest. How do you feel? How do you feel about that?
I feel great. 2000 was super fun, though.
Now, say this one with me. Say this one with me. Mm-hmm. The New Jersey Devils.
New Jersey Devils.
That I grew up loving. Specifically the ones that won Stanley Cups.
This is a lot of words. Specifically the ones that won Stanley Cups.
Set the game back 20 years.
Like Colin Campbell's my co-host.
Come on.
They're an interchangeable flock of forwards.
Set the game back.
I would argue 90s expansion set the game back more than the Devils did, because 90s expansion begot a bunch of teams playing that style as well. And it wasn't all of a sudden, it wasn't the Devils playing the trap, it was a bunch of teams that couldn't compete playing the trap, and that was the issue.
Yeah, but the thing about it, the interesting, that's sort of the knee-jerk to it, but we've just gone through, you know, the longest era where the NHL hasn't expanded, and what's happened? Goal scoring's gone down. Normally, last time I did this, it came out positive. Normally, when there is a wave of expansion, by watering down the league, offense actually goes up. Because there are quote-unquote weaker teams, weaker players that are now in the league. Do they fall back to that same system? Yes, but are they as good at it as New Jersey? And that's the real story. New Jersey did it and were great at it.
Yeah, and had the personnel to play it. But isn't the great equalizer now goaltending? As far as
shot blocking,
yeah. So, I mean, like, well, the numbers bear it out that when you expand, talent gets watered down, scoring should go up.
It does.
There's also, like, you know, there's more goalies than we have teams right now that are good. You know, Tampa's got two. The number of teams that have two guys that could easily, one guy could be starting somewhere in the league right now, doing pretty damn well.
And defensive systems.
Mm-hmm.
Getting in lanes.
Now, in fairness to my Devils.
Okay, here we go. We're going to turn the first podcast back defending your Devils.
Let the record show. We didn't have a podcast in 95, so, you know, I got some catching up to do. Okay. Let the record show.
This is the one we won half the cup, right? Okay.
The NHL eventually did alter the rules to make it more difficult to play that style. So I would argue that, you know, it's their own dereliction of duty as a league, as stewards of the league, to have allowed those systems and that style to fester all the way through the 05 lockout.
The big one is shot blocking that no one wants to talk about and no one wants to really address. And we all know it. We're going to tinker with all the size of the nets and the size of the equipment, regardless of how goaltenders play, regardless how we can say, oh, if the goaltender's equipment is going to be, it will be shrunk, all of a sudden goals are going to be going in everywhere and corners are going to be picked, ignoring the fact that almost every shot ends up in the goalie's chest. Let's think about that for 1 second. When you're watching hockey tonight, watch how many shots go into the goalie's chest. Why? Because athletic goaltenders get to places fast now. That's what being an athletic goaltender is. How many just narrowly miss the corner? No, it's goalies that are getting out quicker to position, and pucks are hitting them in the middle of their body. Now, say to yourself, when you see this happen, oh, wow, the puck just hit the goaltender in the chest. He made that save. Can you imagine if the equipment was shrunk? You know what the difference would be? Zero. Mm-hmm. Nothing.
And also, just to continue our journey down the rabbit hole that are the Columbus Blue Jackets, a.k.a. a study in nothing possibly making sense anymore, they're a John Tortorella team, and they're 17th in block shots. Also, they've won a bajillion games in a row, and they have a face-off winning percentage of under 48. Nothing makes sense anymore.
Maybe face-offs are only part of an entire sequence of possession and shouldn't be given primacy. You know what? That's a great jump-in point for our guest, Dmitry Filipovich from the
really
PBO cast, who is standing by. Dmitry,
yep.
First of all, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good afternoon to you guys, too. What's up?
Dmitry, before we begin, I owe you an apology for, I believe, referring to you as Dmitry Filatov on Puck Soup.
Yeah, he's been stealing my identity for a few years now.
Dmitry Filatov.
Forgetting that you know, Nikita Filatov was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Philly don't do rebounds, right?
Yeah.
Philly don't play defense.
And Popovich is not. Yeah. Hey, where are you at on faceoffs and their importance? I tend to believe that coaches love them because it's easy to look at a faceoff and say, that's something I can quote unquote control, as opposed to something like a board battle, which is essentially a faceoff for a player like Marian Hossa before him, Ryan Smith. But there's not a really simple, easy way to quantify it or even work on it in a lot of ways. Your thoughts on faceoffs?
Generally, whenever you're watching a game and they flash that graphic of like the best guys or the best teams in the league, I kind of roll my eyes just because I think they're overselling the importance of it. Like, obviously, you'd rather win the faceoff than not. And there's certain situations, like whether you're on the power play, for example, or there's the clock ticking and there's not that much time left in the period where you'd like to win it to secure possession instantly. But there's so many of these sequences. If you just watch the game where it's like the guy wins a faceoff and then 2 seconds later, the other team just retrieves the puck and it's like, what was the whole point of that? So I think it's like the value of it is just way overblown by traditional hockey people.
Yeah, and you have some of the players being honest about it too. I think Getzlaf was one of the guys when he was asked about his faceoff percentage at one point, was just like, look, you got to watch the plays, man. Like, yeah. our system is geared for me not to win the faceoff, and that's why I don't win the faceoff.
If you look at, I mean, this is a great example. If you look at when Getzlaf is on the ice, okay, and he's out there and the other team is trapped. They've got their third pairing D. They've got their fourth line. Getzlaf will deliberately lose that faceoff. Why? Because, you know, the forecheck is going to be strong. They're going to turn the puck over right around the net and there's going to be a scoring chance. Why should that be a negative that he lost that draw?
Yeah, it's kind of weird that, like, you're winning the faceoff, but you're technically moving the puck further away from where you want to get it to. So it seems like it's kind of a bit counterintuitive.
That said, Patrice Bergeron for Selke. Dimitri, can you explain the Blue Jackets?
How much time do we have to get into it?
Time is a flat circle, my friend. We have all the time we need.
You know what? Here's where I'm at with them. It kind of reminds me of the winning streak the Panthers went on last year. I think it was 12 games, and the Blue Jackets have won 13 now. But these sort of extended winning streaks are the worst just because they cause the pendulum to swing to such extremes in terms of the opinions people have on them. Like, there's the camp that looks at how many games they've won in a row and just automatically concludes that they must be the best because they're not losing any games. And then there's that ensuing pushback of the well actually crowd where it's like, well, they're not actually playing this well. But I think it's like, in the NHL, especially now, there's so much parity and it's so close that stringing together this many games takes some combination of talent and luck. And I think that's where the Blue Jackets are at. Obviously, they're not going to keep scoring on as many shots as they're taking right now. And, you know, Bobrovsky's not going to keep playing this well, but their 5-on-5 performance has improved as the year has gone along. And their power play right now is possibly one of the funnest, kind of most well-reasoned things in the league, like just the way they've assembled it, all of it seems to click and make sense together. So I think that they do have things working for them. They're going to start losing some games eventually, but I think we need to recalibrate our preseason expectations for sure.
But again, like, and I'm glad you brought up the thing, because here's the thing, right? Like, when we were all looking at the numbers earlier in the year, and we saw power play over 30%, and we said, okay, well, I ain't going to last. And then we saw a really high PDO, and then we saw puck possession numbers that were below 50%, in some cases significantly. At the time, based on the evidence, you could say, well, this is unsustainable. But then, like you said, they became a better possession team as the season went on. So if you do that, then it becomes sustainable. So I just don't get this backlash from CBJ fans that are all just like, well, you guys said this wasn't going to last. Well, at that rate, if they had continued to play the way they were playing, no, it wouldn't have lasted, but they got better.
Yeah, I think we're also, as analysts and evaluators, we're allowed to change our opinion based on new information as it presents itself, right? Like, I think that early in the season, we had no reason to believe that they would be this team, but they kept playing this well and have improved legitimately as the year's gone along, and I think now we're allowed to say that they're definitely going to be better than we thought they'd be.
You know, it is, every year there's that, generally that one outlier, that one, the Minnesota, the Calgary, the Toronto, the Colorado, the Anaheim, it seemed for 2 years, remarkably, who sort of dine out on that high shooting and save percentage. Maybe when you look at, because it seems as if 2005 to me has now caught up to the NHL finally. What they wanted, the goal from 2005 with the parity and everything's 50-50 hockey and stick around right to the end and there's going to be races right down to the final game of the season. It's going to be so hard to make up ground, but everyone's going to kind of look like they're all together and give the appearance that everybody has a chance. Do we just look at ourselves now after having gone through so many years of this post-2005 lockout and say to ourselves, this is just what happens when you have a parity league. You're going to have some teams that go on long stretches of winning streaks, long stretches of losing streaks. That's just what happens when you have parity and not a couple of measuring stick teams and then everybody else.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that, I mean, that's part of the fun of the sport. Like, if we knew exactly how it's going to turn out and could, you know, have this formula, it's like, okay, this team's going to be this good no matter what. Like, it wouldn't be fun. We wouldn't be playing these games. We wouldn't be watching it and following it on a daily basis. So I think that every year we have a couple of these teams. And it's funny you mentioned the Wild as a team of the past, but I think the Wild are a much, much better example this year than the Blue Jackets, was sort of one of these a bit fraudulent teams that are playing way over their head. Like, it's funny that the Blue Jackets have become this poster team of like unsustainability just because they've been winning a lot of games. But the Wild are sort of in a similar boat with them, but have way less to fall back on once the percentages dip.
Yeah, and the percentage at last time I checked was circling around a 945 save percentage for Dubnyk, which is just insane that he's been able to pull it off. But again, like, I agree that they're not a good team, the Wild, but there's that sort of unquantifiable Bruce Boudreau pixie dust that gets sprinkled on these teams sometimes, and then all of a sudden you look up and Eric Staal has 29 points in 34 games. Like, just, it's hockey, right?
Yeah, I Bruce Boudreau's the best. Like, I can't describe what he's doing there, but those Anaheim teams for a few years there as well, like, were riding these completely unsustainable records in one-goal games, and then as soon as he leaves this year, they've kind of fallen off there, and it just, I don't know what kind of strings he's pulling or what he's telling the players, but it's working.
Always interesting come the end of the season, and maybe you just award it to, we just started awarding the Jack Adams Trophy to goaltenders, which is my latest little stump. Let's just give the coach of the year to the best goaltender. Or it ends up being the coach whose team has the highest PDO. We've seen it before, whether it's Hartley, whether it's Patrick Waugh. But for you, over the past, someone that watches this closely, Dimitri, over the past, let's say, 5 years, who's been the most impressive coach that never won the Jack Adams? Is it too easy just to say, oh, it's got to be Mike Babcock, or am I missing something?
Yeah, I think Babcock's definitely up there. I mean, a guy like John Cooper as well is someone I'm really high on, just in terms of sort of the progressive way he goes about building his lineups and deploying his players. And just when he talks, it just like all of it makes sense. I'm a big John Cooper fan, but I think those two guys are sort of the cream of the crop. And it's funny to look back at now. It's like Bob Hartley, Patrick Waugh, Paul McLean. These guys were all deemed the best coach of that season. And I remember reading articles at the time of how they'd all sort of figured out, you know, how to win these close games and how to beat the Corsi crowd, and all of a sudden, yeah, you know, in hindsight, hasn't aged very well.
It's interesting too, and this comes down to, I mean, there are numbers, and numbers are just numbers, and it depends on how you interpret them. Because I've been on this bandwagon for a while. This idea that, you know, if you have a team that wins, let's just pick out a number, 25 one-goal games. You know, a lot of people would look at that stat and say, wow, this is a team that knows how to win close games, this is a team that's going to be great in the playoffs. Or other people would look at it and say, hold on a second here, you're playing with fire. Like, that is dangerous, winning that many one-goal games. You are due for a huge crash.
Yeah, generally good teams don't leave it up for chance like that. They generally win their games by 2, 3, 4 goals. And obviously, you know, the better teams are going to wind up winning a higher percentage of those one-goal games just because they're generally better than their opposition. But you're kind of playing with fire there, and I think that if you're either too high or too low on that spectrum, it's going to even out over time. So that's something I definitely look at.
Yeah, and I was really enjoying on Twitter today the chart you put out of the percentage of time leading at 5-on-5 and the percentage of time trailing at 5-on-5 teams. And there's one number, going back to our conversation about Minnesota, that really stuck out for me, which is Minnesota's trailed at 5-on-5 under 17% of their total 5-on-5 ice time, which is the best number by far on that chart. What do you think that says about them?
Well, I think it's pretty good. I mean, clearly, you know, they're playing ahead, and I think that's why we have all these adjustments for the 5-on-5 numbers, because their raw totals, if they're playing ahead so frequently, you know, they're not going to look very favorably upon them. But no, it's crazy that they're trailing only under 17% of the time, and then you look at a team like Vancouver, it's like up to near 50%, and it's just mind-boggling. Like, it's tough to kind of even wrap your head around how big of a difference that is. Like, we're talking like, what, 400, 500 minutes of a 5-on-5 ice time discrepancy between those two teams, which is nuts.
Yeah, and then also on that tip, I mean, a team that I have nothing but sympathy for because of the situation they were put in this year, but Colorado on your chart, 17.6% of the time they've been leading at 5-on-5, which is just absolutely god-awful.
Well, it's really funny. Something I've been paying attention to lately has been, you know, Arizona's not even trying to pretend like they're trying to win games this year, like with the lineups they're fielding, but Mike Smith is single-handedly keeping them in a lot of these games. And then, you know, they don't even have the greatest odds for the first overall pick at this point, just because of how atrocious Colorado's been, and even teams like the Canucks and the Islanders as well are down there. It's going to be quite a rock fight towards the end of the year trying to improve those odds.
You know, further on Colorado, you wonder, because I would imagine that Joe Sakic's under a lot of pressure to do something. If they pull the trigger and move one of those forwards, and I know there's a hue and cry in Colorado, Avs fans, people in the organization, they need to make a move and bust up one of those pieces to try to address the defense issue. Last time I checked, no one's letting go a defenseman. And second of all, how much do we really know about these forwards, given they've never really had a blue line to play with? Like, it's a tough spot for Sakic, I get it. But given that that team has little to no defense, no help for those forwards from the back end, how do you trade something that you don't know what it is?
I'll say this, Goat Boys. I mean, based on everything you just said, they can probably pull Adam Larson in a trade.
Yeah. Then
no, but Dimitri is well taken.
But hang on. But
how do you evaluate those guys?
The question there is, though, where do you hide the ski mask?
Yeah.
Why do I have music in my ears right now?
Lots to get to. We'll bounce around the world.
Now I have the Andrew Walker show in my ears.
Now it's gone. Are we good now? Okay, cool.
Now we're good. Yeah, that was a nice little musical interlude.
Was it,
Dimitri?
Really?
It's coming from your phone. You there, Dimitri?
Merrick, are you there?
Slovakia in the U.S. tonight.
No, now we got Andrew Walker. Hang on, Derek's trying to figure it out. We got Derek pinch hitting today for Sam, who's still in Owen Sound.
That was exciting because I felt like Dimitri's answer was being relayed to us in house music.
I think it was Metrics. Cool
was
band.
It Metric?
So I think I was digging on that for a second. All of a sudden, Dimitri's got. It's like pro wrestling, but his answers all have their own theme song. Like, that's how far advanced this guy is in how to do media.
To pause on Colorado for a second as we get Dimitri back, I read a piece in the Denver Post about, like, Jared Bednar at Christmas, and the inference was, the whole premise of it was like, well, it won't be his only Christmas here in Denver. I'm like, really? Like, it's guaranteed he's coming back? I guess so. I guess my thing is this. When I look at the Islanders and I look at Colorado out of this season, I say to myself, how is there not total regime change in both places after this year?
Yeah, these are both composition issues.
Specifically with Colorado, it's
the back end.
Yeah, but how do you possibly entrust Joe Sakic to make the necessary moves to make this roster successful? You don't. And Snow's going to be on his ass as soon as they hire a team president, clearly.
I was surprised they let him do the Clutterbuck deal.
Yeah, I know. Well, I feel like they're in sort of a holding pattern until they hire a team president. I feel like the owners are still getting their feet wet there. But I think in both cases, it's like I could see Bednar coming back, but I don't see him coming back if all of a sudden there's a GM in place.
It might just be like Chris McFarland, who gets bumped up from the assisted to the big GM chair.
Oh, a little Washington, whose name completely... Oh, Brian McClellan. There it is.
Brian McClellan. Yeah. I think we have Dimitri back. Dimitri?
Yeah, that was very weird.
Well, all of a sudden, Metric came in as a musical interlude. Do you remember what the question was that we asked about a half hour ago?
The Avalanche or something like that.
Yeah, about how can you tell those guys the value of those guys if they play on horrible teams?
It's really tough. It's really tough to just properly evaluate them. I think it's a great point Jeff mentioned about not having puck movers in the blue line beyond a guy like Tyson Barrie to actually get them the puck. And this is like one of the big reasons why I always thought a guy like Taylor Hall wasn't really even getting a fair shake. Like, his numbers were great regardless in Edmonton, but he always had to go back in his own zone to retrieve the puck and take it the full length of the ice. And he never got the luxury of sort of having defensemen spring him for breakaways and easy odd man rushes. So I think that, you know, you got to trade good players to get good players generally, but I don't really see a trade out there that makes a ton of sense where you're not going to be selling low on a guy like Matt Duchene. So it's not a very great option, but I would just sit on these players right now, you know, get a high draft pick and try and figure it out this summer as opposed to making a panic trade right now.
I'm with you. Honestly, it's uncomfortable for a lot of people around the organization. I think they have to sit on this one. You know, unless you can hit the home run and bring that young puck moving defenseman in, which no one is letting go of, there's maybe an outside chance of springing someone from Anaheim. But honestly, I think you're stuck. Otherwise, you're just going to force yourself in a situation where you give someone up for pennies on the dollar.
Yeah, and a guy like Matt Duchene is under contract for a few more years at a very cheap price, and he's still 25 years old. Like, he's entering his prime right now. So I don't see what that logical trade is there. Generally, you'd be trading him for, you know, a guy you think could become a top pairing defenseman, and I don't think that they're in a position where they could be taking those sorts of risks right now.
Indeed. Hey, Dimitri, before we let you go, mm-hmm. and thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely, anytime.
What were your favorite things from 2016 in the land of hockey? The things that you'll take away, the things that stick with you, either from an analytics standpoint or just from a general hockey fan standpoint, besides, obviously, the success of the PDO cast, which we congratulate you on.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the thing that's going to stick with me the most from 2016 is something near and dear to your hearts, and it's going to be the All-Star game and everything surrounding John Scott. I think that's something I'm going to look back at pretty fondly.
Yeah, I'd like to think the year ended in January, too. You know, it was just really good memories in the All-Star game. Never got to November, no elections. Yeah, it was good times.
Honestly, though, the real answer there is I think everything that happened with the Penguins, just because of, at the start of the season, how bad they looked last year under Mike Johnson, and then the changes that they made under Mike Sullivan, and just the complete sort of revamping of that roster and how the way they played and the level they're at right now, I think that, you know, they're poised again to repeat as at least making the Cup final. And I think that they're sort of the standout story from 2016 for me.
And it's funny, too, because it didn't quote-unquote work at first. I think they lost their first three games under Sullivan, and everyone said, oof, man, this Pittsburgh thing's worse than we thought. Last one for me. How has your life changed after Dan Murphy made you a big TV star?
It honestly has not changed at all. I know you can't believe it either, but
you had to grow a big beard so you wouldn't get recognized outside now. And
yeah, they actually made me trim the beard quite a bit for that TV spot, which I was pretty bummed out about.
Did they really?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
No.
I mean, it wasn't one of those things where I showed up and there was just like a woman holding a razor there just waiting for me, but they definitely kind of hinted at, you know, you want to look your best on TV.
I don't know. We kind of got an open door policy on ugly in the hockey department in this industry.
You don't want to look like some vagrant on TV just spouting off about numbers and conspiracy theories. You know, that wouldn't go very well, I don't think. Unless you're wearing a loud jacket, of course. Dimitri, you're the best, sir. And thank you for joining us. And have a happy new year, and we'll talk to you in 2017.
Thanks, guys, as well, man. Let's talk soon.
Thanks, Dimitri.
The man himself, Metric
Zone.
All right,
then. Everything seems to be in order, then.
There we go.
That's it, eh? That's such a tough spot for Colorado. God, I want that team to be so... I was loving the idea of Colorado being a better team this year, weren't you?
We were super excited about it.
Yeah, one of the things in the offseason I was legit excited about was finally seeing a good Colorado team. New coach, new all of it.
Yeah, Corey Rockefeller, now that we dip into the mailbag, wanted to know, make me feel better about being an Avalanche fan this season. Well, I'll hear it. Here's how you feel better about it. One, your coach shanghaied you, so this is a mulligan season. No one's going to be all about, wow, you guys really screwed it up when your coach decides to lose his smile in August, and then you got to scramble around and find best available.
But it wasn't as if the coach was, you know, leading this team to the playoffs every year.
It isn't, but at the same time, it throws the whole thing into chaos. It just does.
That's true.
And that's okay.
That is true.
So,
and who
make
quits?
Yourself feel better?
You have tradable assets.
You have tradable assets. Not every team in the NHL can say they have tradable assets.
Don't. Just move a Ginla and buy a Beauchemin and call it a day. There.
I've yet to make a bunch of, like, I've made some, like, sort of predictions or wishes for 2017. I did not make one about a Ginla, but damn it, I want to see him on Edmonton so bad.
Why? Whose spot do you want him to take?
Sail off into the sunset with the Edmonton Oilers. Play the Flames like maybe one of the last games of the season, knock him out of the playoffs, then go to the playoffs with the Oilers.
Oh, it's going to sound awkward because he's, you know, such a loved hockey hero, but how much hockey does Jerome Ginla have left in him?
Oh, he's bad, but, you know, wait, come on. So what? Ray Bourque gets all this love and whatever, and, like, I suggest Iggy should go to the playoffs with McDavid and the Oilers, and I was like,
but
oh,
he's tried all this.
What is he going to do? Who's going to hold his cane while he skates?
He's had his shots at this. Pittsburgh, Boston, having runs. Listen, I'm happy to watch him go somewhere else. I just don't know that given the position you have to play him at, if you're going to be a Stanley Cup team if you have Jerome Ginla in your top six taking one-timers on the half wall.
Mm-hmm. Corey Raines wants to know, you guys may touch on this already, but how does Team USA leave DeBrincat off the WJC roster? We haven't really talked about the World Juniors yet because you did an entire junior podcast about it, which people can go listen to if they want a little bit of the whole thing.
That was a weird one. I don't know how you leave. And I know there's a lot of like, oh, Bob Motzko just hates the Canadian Hockey League. And listen, there's plenty of the Jeremy Bracco plays in Kitchener Rangers. You know, he left college after, a month and a half to go play in the OHL. So there are some CHL players on that team. I can't figure out the DeBrincat snub. I really can't. You know, back-to-back 50, he's probably going to score 60 this year. I'm probably the best line in the entire CHL. In a tournament where, you know, you need to score some easy goals, and that's the one thing DeBrincat can do, man. You need a goal, bingo, put him out there. Every single level he's played at. And he was on the team last year. Like, that's the one that gets me. On the team last year, this year, cut. Huh?
He didn't have good games leading up to the tournament, remember? That was the rationale, wasn't it?
He didn't have the good summer camp.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
They're allergic to skill. Let's be honest.
They're allergic to skill. I don't know. There's a lot of skill on that USA team, but
they leave it home all the time. They leave goals home all the time. They think that they think chemistry and all this nonsense. It all tracks back to Herb Brooks ruining hockey for America because they chemistried and gritted out a win.
Just chemistry it up.
Yep.
I don't know, man. Like Keller and White and Greenaway and Cunning and Raslovic and Bracco.
Do we have a shot at beating
Bellows?
You guys in this thing? Or
totally
just,
do. Of course you do. Yes. USA's a good team, man. Especially those forwards. The forwards on USA are awesome. And on the back end, if I'm Bob Motzko, I just leave Charlie McAvoy on the ice the whole game.
And will it be your goalie's fault so we can have another referendum on goaltending in Canada?
It's always the goaltender's fault.
Now, hold on. You sound a little harsh. As you know, if Canada loses in World Junior, they're just kids. Just kids.
Now, by the time you get to the WJC, much like by the time you get to the NHL, when you get, specifically in Canada, when you get to the World Junior Hockey Championships, the U-20s, whatever you want to call it, when you get there, you've played in so many high-pressure games in the Hockey Canada system that by the time you get there, there is a pro polish to just about every single player. I've always sort of fallen short on that. Well, you got to remember they're only kids. They haven't been treated like kids in this program for years. So let's just stop. But at the same time, let's not treat this for something more than it is. This is a development tournament. This is a snapshot, a two-week snapshot in these players' careers before they turn pro. The rest of the world looks at it that way. Canada does not.
Referendum on Canada's greatness.
And our worth as people.
Rob Feeney wants to know, do you call an arena blank center or the blank center? I've heard different across broadcast play-by-plays. Coming from the spectrum, anything without the sounds unusual to me. That's an interesting question. I mean, I call it Prudential Center, but I call it The Rock for short.
No, I call it the Prudential Center. I'm putting the in front of everything, usually, I think. I've never noticed that. The Prudential. Yeah, no, I always put the in front of all of them.
Well, hold on. I call it Bell Center. I don't call it the Bell Center, right?
I do. The Bell Center.
You call it the Bell Center? So you put the in front of everything.
Pretty much the Greg Wyshynski.
The Air Canada Center.
I do it.
Yeah. But you call it Joe Louis Arena. The Joe Louis Arena? No.
Yeah, but that's a person, though. I'm not going to say the Greg Wyshynski. Hi, the Greg Wyshynski.
That's because you're pronouncing it wrong. It's the Greg Wyshynski.
Asshole.
Nathan Robinson wants to know, will a team like Vegas, who will surely want star power and will have nothing but cap space, make an offer sheet for Drouin? Tampa Bay is strapped. Well, I guess the bigger question is, would the Golden Knights, still getting used to that, make a push to sign a player to an offer sheet? And I'm going to say no to that, because despite having all that dough, one, you don't want to burn bridges with anybody at this point if you're George McPhee, and that's part of the issue with an offer sheet. And two, you run the risk of losing draft picks. And while I believe, and this is a prediction for 2017, I believe the Golden Knights will be a playoff bubble team in their first season. The diminishing returns to the Western Conference, sir, solid goaltending, a good blue line, and scrounging out enough goals under Ken Hitchcock will make them a bubble team. I don't think that they're going to want to squander any high draft picks for one player on an offer sheet. They want to grow their own.
Yes, correct. I can't see them. I can't see it. I mean, not just if you're George McPhee, but if you're Bill Foley and you've just been allowed into this club, I don't think you want one of your first moves to be, let's pull a trigger and fire one of the bullets that the commissioner of the league hates the most.
I also love the idea that they up the expansion fee so high to make sure he wouldn't have enough cash to tender an offer sheet to anybody for at least 3 years.
That's hilarious. Yeah, but I'm with you. I think they want to spend. I don't think they're in the process of scalping picks.
We've seen your books, Foley. We know you don't get it. You can't afford Drouin. We know this.
Look, man. If I'm Vegas, I don't want to win games next year. I want Rasmus Dahlin, that young defenseman on Sweden. That's what I want.
They're going to be I think your logic doesn't square with where they are. I think they want to be competitive out of the gate, and they know the NHL's game the system to allow them the opportunity to be competitive out of the gate.
I don't know. I think you'll be surprised at how little is available come expansion draft time. That's why I think trade deadline is going to be a fascinating one, because it's not just going to be trades to help teams or teams look for the future, but it's going to be teams preparing themselves for the expansion draft. There's a whole new wrinkle now in trade deadline.
Great goalie. 4 decent defensemen. And,
you might get a couple of second pairing guys in there. You might.
Yeah. Well, you get DeHaan, maybe. Someone like that level.
The curious one is going to see how Anaheim goes about it.
About
what? How do they want to play it? By just protecting all the players or protecting the combination of forwards and D?
Yeah. And what the hell Anaheim's going to do.
Yeah.
Finally, Simon Creamer wants to know, since the World Cup is already an idea laboratory, should the NHL play around with the rules, I just want to see no offside.
So yeah! Yes!
I think the All-Star game is that. I don't like the World Cup. They really take the World Cup seriously. I think the All-Star game is now going to be the guinea pig joint.
But it doesn't mean anything, though.
No, it doesn't.
Like 3-on-3, you do it because it's fun. It's a lot more fun than, even when the guys don't care, 3-on-3 is fun. hockey to watch. It just is. I don't know that you'll be able to glean much by way of, you know, altering the rules. Like, how much can you alter it when you've already gone to the 3-on-3? You need a 3-on-3 and no offsides?
Well, they should make a 3-on-3 no offside anyway in overtime, shouldn't they?
I'm all for it. Isn't one of the coolest things when a guy just, like, grabs a puck and leaves the offensive zone because there's no play? And you're like, oh, wow, we're so used to them holding the line like crazy. This is kind of cool.
When there's a turnover and all of a sudden there's a dude cherry-picking way down ice, like, that's awesome.
Yes, it is.
We didn't talk to Dimitri about his idea that we should have no offside at all.
That's his plank in his platform.
I've
been on that. Funny, because I've been banging that one for a long time now. Just go roller rules, man. Get rid of icings. Get rid of offsides.
Maybe just make the
icings when it comes all the way down the ice. That's it. You just fire it back. But do whatever you can. Because listen, the rinks aren't getting any better. So let's just stop talking about making the rink bigger. Oh, we're going to make it wider. We're going to go finish size. It'll be 200 by 92. No, owners are not going to go for spending millions of dollars to retrofit all of their rinks. It is not going to happen. So let's stop that. So we have a 200 by 85 that 31 teams are going to play with. How do we maximize what's happening on that ice, knowing that once you get the blue line, everybody stands in front of the net and getting shots are next to impossible? Get rid of that little box. There's three boxed areas that people play in: the offensive zone, the neutral zone, the defensive zone. Get rid of the blue lines. Make the boxes bigger. You have the same ice surface. And to your point, you see a guy cherry picking? Great. Oh, he's goal sucking. Oh, that's cheating. No, that's fine. That means there's one less player in the defensive zone to play with. So essentially, you're on a power play. That is a gamble you're taking. So much is calculated and so much is based on percentages. Who gambles? That forces a gamble. You can either leave a defenseman back there to cover, or you can say, screw it, we're going 5-on-4 and taking our chances. It's awesome. Get rid of blue lines.
The idea that it becomes sort of a gamble is what really sold me on the idea. Like, you are running the risk of having the opportunity for these long, like, Hail Mary passes, but at the same time, you could be in a perpetual shorthanded situation in your own zone. I love
that's
that.
That's right.
How does your opponent deal with that player as well, kind of hanging out in the neutral zone?
Well, that's just it. Do you cover him? We just leave him. Either way, you're getting more goals, and we all know it. But no, we'll just tinker with, okay, you're going to have to put your stick down here for the face-off in the offensive zone. And we're going to do a little something. We shave a half a centimeter off the goalposts, and we're going to juice score. No. Get rid of blue lines.
Blow it all up.
Just get rid of blue lines. Yeah. Just get rid of it. Dude, if you want to say, oh, no, I'm a traditionalist. I believe in having blue. When the game first started, there were no blue lines. There were no offsides. Mm-hmm.
Listen to Commissioner Merrick. If you listen to him, we'd be talking about Sid having 82 and 82 by now.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Are you kidding? Connor Sheary would have 82. Never mind Sidney Crosby.
Oh, God. All those little quick
Carl Hagelin with 70 goals and shit. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. All those guys. All right, listen. We've come to the end of 2016. We want to thank everybody who's stuck with us through 2016. Schedules get funny. Jobs get arduous and difficult. Children grow up and demand your time. It's not been the most consistent of years for the podcast, but here we are doing the podcast, which I think is the best part, is that we're still doing this damn thing.
Not interested in going anywhere. This podcast will always continue as long as there are people like Derek that'll show up, thank you, Derek, to produce it. So I ain't going anywhere. I wish I ain't going anywhere.
We thank each and every one of you for sticking with us. Thanks, by the way, for everybody who listened to the John Scott podcast. That put us in a pretty high ranking here in the States on the ye old podcast episodes ranking. I appreciate that. Thanks to Sam for most of the producing this year, and thanks for Derek for the producing today. Thanks to Dimitri for hopping on. Thanks to all of our guests who took time out of their schedules to come on the podcast. Thanks to Sportsnet for facilitating the podcast and making it happen and bringing it to you on a semi-regular basis. And thanks to my good buddy Jeff Merrick, who
Hey, pal.
He's a lovely human being and a dedicated father and infinitely more talented than I am, which is why he's much busier than me.
Oh, please. Please. I'm just trying to juggle having a career and being a hockey dad and got the rink going, buddy. So 2 hours before I came on, it's just out in the back skating with the kids. So I'm living that life, too. So it's just, it's been challenging. It's funny because I was talking to someone on Twitter yesterday about, you know, the good old days when this used to be 5 days a week. I was talking to my wife about this the other day, too. Man, we used to do so much stuff. I mean, you and I used to do, like, tons of stuff. We had great ideas for the podcast. Could do this, can do that. Now we're squeezing out an episode a week.
Yeah. You know, in fairness, it was probably like 4 a week, and then I would do Game Show Friday.
So 4.5, and you do Game Show Friday, and I'd like go downstairs and make a coffee.
You'd be like, I gotta go. But listen,
Jay's
everybody
gonna do Game Show again.
Everybody who came out to the live shows, much appreciated. We got another one cooking that may or may not be in Canada. And just like thanks. I mean, like again, like I've listened to many podcasts, I've read many blogs during my time in the digital media that don't exist anymore, and it bums me out. And sometimes they go to better places, like our dear friend James Myrtle, who now is the editor-in-chief of The Athletic, which is great for him.
Can we get him on now?
We can definitely get him
on. Are we allowed?
It's free and clear.
He's good? Okay.
But it makes me happy whenever things that I love still linger, and I'm sure that, you know, for a lot of you, you love this show inexplicably, and I think that it's great that, you know, despite everything, we can still keep it chugging along at a pretty respectable rate and at the usual levels of quality, which is to say...
Quality. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, we're all moving to corner offices, Greg.
That's
a high-quality broadcast we've delivered people.
And in Toronto, that means one of us has a view of construction at all times.
No kidding. Wellington. I look at it every day that I'm there.
Am I driving to that damn city?
It's like, is this a hockey practice or Toronto? There's so many pylons all over the place.
It's like Dark City. It's just constantly being shifted and changed around while people.
Listen, I'm glad that you're able to go on now that the world is down one Princess Leia, Carrie Fisher. I'm just happy that you were able to survive all this.
Here I thought Zsa Zsa was going to be the only princess they took. But lo and behold, they weren't done taking princesses.
I guess it's that icon. I've always felt it weird when someone passes away and you refer to them as their movie name. Like, let's say Tom Cruise dies this afternoon. Is, like, Jerry Maguire going to start trending?
No.
Oh, man, we lost Jerry Maguire.
No, I think it's if you have more than one iconic character, then it's not going to be like that. But for her, it was always Princess Leia. For Mark, when Mark Hamill dies, it'll be Luke Skywalker.
It'll be
dies.
Luke Skywalker.
You're
when
right. Harrison You're Ford right. dies, what do you do? Han Solo's dead. Indiana Jones is dead. Guy from Blade Runner's dead. Henry from Regarding Henry is dead. Who knows? You got somebody to choose.
Guy from the opening scene in Apocalypse Now.
Yeah. That's right.
Hey, you like that pull? Even I know that one, Greg. Hey, hey, hey.
Sexy dude from American Graffiti. But yeah, when C-3PO dies, it's C-3PO dies. Let's be honest.
It's going to be C-3PO.
Absolutely.
I always thought that AC/DC 3PO would be a good band name.
Never tell me the odds!
All right. That's about
That's it. Fun and merriment. Now, real back to your real lives.
Okay.
Everybody dismissed from the podcast.
Happy New Year, sir. And we'll talk in
to you too.
2017. By the time we talk again, we'll have the Centennial Classic in the books.
Affordable tickets are available on your local ticket broker sites.
Mm-hmm. And I will be in St. Louis for the Winter Classic on January 2nd.
I will not. I will not be working that one, but I will be in Quebec City at the end of the month for the CHL-NHL Top Prospects game on the 30th.
And I will also be in LA for
this month.
For the All-Star Game and the revelation of the full list of the Nelson Canadian 100 hockey people of power and influence of all time list.
Not ranked, though, right? Like, not numbered. Just Here's 100.
Oh, as if they would ever do that to upset the apple cart. And by the way, I mean, I think the reason they're not ranking him is because they found a way to pay Gretzky enough to be the ambassador, and they weren't going to sit around and have him be like, oh, you know, it's probably Gordy. I think Gordy's probably number one. Like, come on, Wayne, just stop.
Okay, here's a question someone asked me the other day.
Yeah.
Since expansion 67, mm-hmm. we're all on the same page that the three best players we've seen are Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux, Bobby Orr.
Correct.
We're all on the same page about that? Like those are the three since 67 so. Expansion. Mm-hmm. Who's four?
Well, I mean, are we going skaters or goalies?
That's anyone who's on the ice.
Goalies,
anyone
Hasek,
who's competing.
Goalies, Hasek, skaters.
See, I go either Hasek or Lidstrom. Yeah, that's how I go either Hasek or Lidstrom.
I go Lidstrom over Bork personally, but that's also
so do I. 7 days a week.
But I mean, I got a little skin in that game, to be honest with you.
Exit you do?
16W, you assholes. not only did you take our cup, you ruined an exit on the turnpike for me. Perpetuity.
Yeah, to me it's either Hasek or Lidstrom. A lot will tell you Messier, right? Iserman. I go Lidstrom or Hasek.
The devil's fan in me goes Hasek, Brodeur, Wah, but I probably, push comes to shove, probably have to go. Only because Wah did it in two places, man. That's tough. That's tough to ignore. And I know that's not fair to Marty, that all he did was backstop the same team for two decades to multiple conference titles and three Stanley Cups.
Yeah.
But seeing Wah do what he did with a Montreal team that was great in front of him and then go to Colorado and do the same thing there, again, with another really good team in front of him. But that's pretty damn good. I don't know. I'd probably put Marty ahead of him anyway, just because he's Marty.
Pom-poms.
Well, it's tough. Do I overrate Marty because he played in a system with those defensemen, or do I overrate Wah because he obviously has been elevated to deity status by the Canadian hockey media?
I would go Marty over Patrick Wah.
That makes me
just
feel
because
better.
Just because of the bigger the wider skill set that Marty had.
But Hasek.
And if you talk about changing the game, and that's what Bobby Orr did, and that's in some ways what Dominic Hasek did. I think it was a change of game. It was just sort of a freak that we all looked at and said, what the F is that? But it worked. But Marty changed it.
We should probably go, but I will leave you all with this thought, and I was thinking about this the other day as I was doing some centennial stuff. Would Dominic Hasek, in an age of social media, would Dominic Hasek, what would he have been? Like, would we treat Dominic Hasek like we treat Tarasenko and some of these guys that are human highlight reels, like Connor, for example? Like, whenever Connor does something amazing, it's all over GIF world and Twitter and everything else. Like, would Hasek have been a superstar, celebrity, megastar goaltender even more than he was if the things that he did in any given game were turned into viral highlights on Twitter and social media?
He would have been a superstar.
He would have complete been price superstar. Of admission guy, I think.
I'd be curious what the goaltending community would have done with him. Right? Because it's always been, you know, the idea of making the spectacular save just means you're out of position.
Right.
But he was consistently out of position. That was part of the strategy.
Yeah.
It's wildly unpredictable. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was always the knock on Brodeur. You know, where were the highlight reel saves? Well, just so happens he knew how to play the position better than anyone in
position.
His
generation. Listen, man, Eddie Belfour went to the Hall of Fame and tell me how many spectacular saves he made. He's just always in great position.
Yeah. That's why, God bless Mika Kiprusoff, but there's a reason he had to flash up his leg like a scorpion stinger half the time.
Cool-ass save, though.
It was a cool-ass save, still, man.
Scorpion saves the best. I love scorpion saves.
Most exciting goalie I ever saw was Roman Čechmánek. Why? Because he couldn't handle the puck. He'd swim back to his crease after every time he touched the puck.
Roman Čechmánek, I've heard that one for a while. Oh, wow. Right. Old Flyers goalie pulls. Next week, Tommy Soderstrom.
Man. I'll tell you, kids, there was a time when the Flyers didn't have a goalie, let alone two.
Now, son, sit down. Let me tell you about Robert Esch.
All right. I'm done.
Yeah, me too. But I gotta go.
All right, man. Happy New Year. We'll see you guys next year. Take care. Bye.